support comes from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado, a proud partner of the public broadcasting stations that keep Coloradans better informed.
Good evening and welcome to Outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. Tonight, you'll be listening to a 2015 archive from Dr. Nita Mosby Henry, now Tyler, talking about intersectionality, pain, and privilege, and lots more back from Gay Pride. We'll be doing this as a part one, and there will be a part two. Stay tuned. I guarantee it's worth it.
Good evening and welcome to Outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and in the Denver studio, we have Dr. Nita Mosby Henry, most recently a Grand Marshal for the 2015th Denver Pride Parade. She's an award-winning diversity leader recognized both nationally and locally. She was named one of the most powerful and influential women of Colorado in 2014, according to the Colorado and National Diversity Councils. She received a 5280 Award from Denver Mayor Hancock, an Inclusiveness Award from the National Diversity Council, and awards from the Human Rights Campaign and the Colorado Black Women for Political Action. Dr. Mosby Henry has served on the boards of the Human Rights Campaign, the One Colorado Education Fund, and the National Diversity Council. Currently the Senior Vice President and Chief Inclusion Officer of Children's Hospital, she was the former Executive Director of the Office of Human Resources for the City and County of Denver. At Denver Gay Pride, she challenged the crowd with the real context in which we all live, balancing race, gender, ability, immigration, age, disabilities, and much more. Give a listen.
All of the work that we've done in this community continues to have context. Context is what happens when you wake up in the morning and you find out that 9 innocent people died in a Bible study. Context. Context is the fact that I've got 2 friends, Courtney Gray and Leo Katari, in the transgender community that still continue to be marginalized in this community. That's context. Context is that I have to keep talking about Black Lives Matter because they haven't in this country. That is context. Context is that my brown brothers and sisters would keep talking about immigration as if they are visitors in the country that they built. That's context. Context. Context is about women who still continue to make less money than men for doing the same work. That's context. Context is our elder LGBT members of our community that we continue to marginalize and not tap the wisdom that they have for us. That's context. Context is our disabled community who are every bit a part of this community, and sometimes we forget all about it. That's context. So Pride is about context. Context. Every move you make. One thing that I know to be true in my life, and I hope that you will know this in yours, is that the cure for the pain is in the pain. And we have pain. And the cure for all of the things that we've talked about, all of the social and economic justice issues that we've talked about, come from the pain that we'll go through to accomplish that work.
You brought up many issues in the little teeny, that's like a minute and a half. And in front of a crowd that's kind of known for partying, brought up a lot of issues, a lot of constituencies that also spread across the spectrum of diversity. Race, gender, age, sexual orientation, disabilities, immigration, class or economic status, more. So these cut across all of our identities. How do you balance all that? How do we hold all of that?
You know, I think it's an incredible time in history for the LGBT community. We have had the privilege of being really monolithic in the way in which we have looked at ourselves. We've looked at GLBTQ without the cross-cutting intersections. And so I think the new balancing act is that we make most prominently the conversation about intersections, and a lot of the context that I talked about at Pride Fest was really about us paying homage to the rich intersections that go across our community. I think it's mandatory. I think that's the balancing act, that we call it mandatory, that we recognize at all times that we are a beautiful community with rich differences, and that we raise all of those up as considerations in all that we do.
Totally agree with you. However, I noticed that we tend to talk over and over just about marriage at the national level and somewhat at the local levels. That's what's getting the attention, not the breadth of our communities and our communities' issues.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. I think it's much easier to focus on a singular type of policy or civil rights issue than it is to have a good conversation about what I think are social justice and economic justice issues. That's such an amorphous sort of topic that sometimes mm-hmm. people are overwhelmed by, where do you start boiling this ocean? And my thought is it's time to start boiling that ocean and imagine if we could remedy the economic and social justice issues that we have mm-hmm. just in our community, how big of a lift we'd have in our overarching LGBT community.
And yet that's a giant task. Most people don't have a clue how to begin to wrap their arms around.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there. So when I think about all of the work that's happened over the past decades, lots of studies have happened, and we've done deep dives into health and wellness in the LGBT community. We've looked at some class analytics. So I think in a very disjointed way, we already have the data, but we need to paint the picture about what that data actually says about our community. I think, unfortunately, what we've done is we have reconciled the data when it's attached to a policy issue or a law that we're trying to carry. So what we've got to decide as a community is, how do we take these social and economic justice disparities and inequities and then attach those to something that we might be able to mm-hmm. carry legislatively.
Mm-hmm. This is part of how some of our LGBTQIA organizations need to pull together and help each other, as well as some of the mainstream organizations that serve all of our populations. How's the average little person get involved with that?
So I, those that know me well know that I say this ad nauseum, that I think until organizations, large or small, can create the right definition for what diversity versus inclusion actually looks like and means, we will continue to have these type of what I think are shallow conversations about how to solve for mm-hmm. what I think are big community issues. So we have to make the departure now from just talking about diversity and having actions that are just about diversity. You know, I've got my woman on the board. I've got my mm-hmm. transgender mm-hmm. person on the
check,
board.
Check,
check, check, check. Mm-hmm. And we've got to move from that to, now that I have these people that are rich in what they bring to the table on board and on the board, what am I going to do with that, which is what inclusion is. This is the framework for the context that I talked about at Pride Fest, that you don't make decisions in an organization without having the context of the people that are sitting right in front of you. So I think we've got more work to do on some of the basics in organizations, and that's how we'll foster the change in our communities.
Mm-hmm. So we need people that are involved with the organizations, either as staff or volunteers, to insist on a breadth of people at the table, but then to say, okay, now we have more voices here. Now what?
Now
how do
what?
We do this work
That's
together?
Right. That's right. The action piece hasn't happened yet. I think traditionally in this country, we have assumed that diversity in and of itself was the action. And mm-hmm. what I'm saying is that's a wonderful start, and it is not the action. That inclusion really is the action. Mm-hmm. That's where all the context sits.
Mm-hmm. So you're really making a distinction, almost as if diversity is about getting the right people at the table in the organization, in the group, and the action piece of now what is the inclusiveness part.
That's not just more frill, more
window dressing.
That's right.
You at the table, but I don't want you to talk about
that's
your
right. You just sit there and look pretty. Right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And even if I simplify what you said so beautifully, I would say to you that diversity is counting people and inclusion is making people count. And it's time to make people count in what we're doing.
I think that's really helpful for our listeners to get a handle around, because we can get all mixed up in all the words and not know really, okay, well, what are we left with? I think that that's helpful to think in that way. Another thing you said in your speech is the cure for pain is in the pain.
Yes.
What do you mean by that? That sounds kind of scary.
It sounds scary and it's pretty deep, and I know that every time I say it, but I really do mean it. I think oftentimes the hurt that we go through, no matter what that hurt is about, is the very thing that causes us fear to proceed. We either are afraid to proceed or we're too angry to proceed. And my point in the cure for the pain is in the pain is the pain is actually the power to proceed. So we've got to shift, I think, the way that we use the pain to either be paralyzed or to move forward. And so I encourage people everywhere I go to take the pain, whatever that pain is, as the mobilizer for what's next, as hard as that is. And most times when I say that, once people can really reconcile what that means, I think people really get it, that this, you know, I can tell you as a Black woman, I was born into pain. I was born into pain around discrimination and racism and being a woman and being a part of the LGBT community, and I can go on and on and on and on. And imagine if I allowed that sort of magnitude of pain to immobilize me. I wouldn't be here with you today. Instead, what I decided to do is to take every bit of that pain as the fuel for making sure that future generations didn't have to go through what I went through. And we all need to do that. That's how you solve for social and economic justice issues, I think, that we've got in our community.
So for you, as a woman who has experienced quite a bit of pain in many different areas, you're saying use it for action, and then someone like myself that has privilege, at least in the white arena, and others, many others, to use my privilege or my lack of pain in certain areas for action as well.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Use your privilege to further agendas, and also sit with this. Just because you have privilege doesn't mean you don't have pain. And so be true to yourself about that too. So oftentimes I think when we talk about communities that are traditionally oppressed, we assume those are the only places where pain sits. And I believe with all of my heart that whether you're privileged or not, pain is present somewhere. We have this wonderful opportunity to leverage that.
Well, and I think that's why if we look at all of our many identities, each of us has many identities in one little body. And if you look across all of our identities and histories within each individual, there's pain and privilege in most people on both sides of that. I know that some folks very much, as soon as you bring up privilege, run away.
Yes.
Or pain, run away.
Yes.
So I think it's about holding both, which is not easy.
No, it's not easy. It really calls for a lot of introspection to lift up that both of those could exist in the same person. And in many cases, and I'll use myself as an example, we spend a lot of our lives trying to make the pain go away, so you don't want to remember that it exists. So yeah, it's a tough balancing act.
Well, and I think that we have a lot of evidence in our country and in our own community. I mean, I think we're, unfortunately, we tend to be heavy smokers and drinkers in the queer community, at least. And I think some of that is about socializing and some of it is about pure pain.
It's pain. It's pain. It is absolutely pain manifesting in destructive ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the privilege is that sometimes we can just call that socializing. That's privilege.
Right.
That's right.
And a way to look away from the pain.
That's exactly right.
Well. And you're saying look in.
Look in and use that as power.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and you're listening to Dr. Nita Mosby-Henry, now Tyler, talking about intersectionality, pain, privilege, and much more.
Now, at the march, there was what some people are calling a disruption, where some of our youth halted the whole march and really lifted up some issues. Some of the same youth disrupted, quote unquote, the Creating Change conference that was in here in Denver a couple months ago. And there's mixed response to that. Some people were very supportive and others very annoyed and want to ignore it. And this is, again, one of those looking at the privilege and the pain side. What, I don't know if you were noticing that in the march. I mean, you know, when you're a grand marshal, you may have a lot of duties. I didn't even know if you knew what was going on there.
I was the grand marshal, so I was at the very beginning of the parade, so I actually missed seeing it. What I would say to you, when we have young people that are disruptive in that way, that is their attempt to have power in a matter that may be being ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think all over the country, our young people are being disruptive in this way. And it goes back to something that I just said to you a few minutes ago. If there's no way to face into social and economic injustices, then disruption is born. And we see that all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's fascinating right now is that you're starting to see, particularly in our young people, the intersection conversation that I had with you, that some of the most unlikely people are the ones being the disruptors on issues that have been in our country from the very beginning. I frankly find it refreshing. People call it disruption. There's something refreshing about people that are using their privilege and their pain at the same time to send a message about what we ought to be paying attention to in this country.
Do you see a shift going on? There's so many incidences that are starting to get, like, national attention, you know, whether it is about Charleston or it is about Jesse Hernandez, that there are, it's not like these are, sadly, new things happening. These things have been going on and on and on. And yet there's something that's getting picked up, it seems like, that hasn't been picked up and dealt with before.
I agree with you. I think the attention to some of the social issues is greater than anything I've ever seen. And I'm a 1960s baby, so I've seen them for a long time. I do think, though, what makes them different is the spokespeople for a lot of these issues are younger people. It also, one of the differences is some of the progress in this movement is leaderless. You know, in the past, we had pretty identifiable leaders that were in the forefront of whatever these movements were. We now are leaderless in a lot of cases, and the work is still progressing. I think that makes it very different. And I also think the third thing that makes what's happening now very different is this is intersection work that's at play. And we're not singular. So if you're talking about police brutality, in that same sentence, you're talking about racism. In that same sentence, you're talking about hate crimes. And so we've got cross-cutting conversation going on now, and that's really different than what we saw historically.
And for folks that are unclear about all that, I mean, if they look back at where did the gay pride marches all happen, it's back at the riots happening back at Stonewall with the trans and the drag queens.
That's right.
You know, it's a long history that part of that I'm proud of dissent.
Yes.
And pushing the broader population forward.
That's right.
We slowly move.
That's right. We move forward. Privilege occurs. We move backwards. We move mm-hmm. forward. I mean, I just think that's the evolution of mm-hmm. people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Equity was never talked about historically. No one contemplated that equity would be the thing. As a matter of fact, this country was built on the opposite of equity. And so as we've progressed through the decades and we've decided that equity is really what we want, we have to realize we have no infrastructure for that. Mm-hmm. We've built nothing that supports an equitable society. And so the disruption and the fight and the pain and all of that is the building of a system that truly does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful.
Those are very heavy statements that would probably scare a lot of people.
Yes.
To say, what do you mean there's no structure? What do you mean? What about this? What about that?
Right. Not everyone can go and get a college degree. Not everyone can go and get a job. Not everyone can vote. Not everyone can live in certain communities. That's not really equity.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't built that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel hopeful. I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist. I feel hopeful that we will have an equitable society, but it will take pain and privilege and its intersection for that to occur.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me shift just a little bit, and I've seen in some of you have a Twitter account. you tweet about the breadth of diversity on it as well. You pass along great things on so many issues, the intersectionality issues that you've just been talking about. But other things I've seen you talk about in a couple different articles, if they've reported your words correctly, is you've counseled others in when they do have leadership positions to be vulnerable and authentic. And some people might think that's very risky. And others might think, well, yeah, you're a high level lady, you know, easy for you to say.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about your advice.
Yeah, it's real advice. And I got to be the high-level lady because I started being vulnerable when I wasn't.
Uh-huh.
So I think what's really important is that you are always authentically who you are and that you not let the employer or the job or the title define what that actually means. And that's always been really helpful for me to keep at the forefront of my consciousness. Throughout my career that started when I was in my early 20s, I never really shifted from that consciousness. It was important for me to just be who I was. I've been out at work since I started work.
Mm-hmm.
I am really clear about what I know and what I don't know. I am really clear about what things look like and what they feel like. And because that's become a part of how I move, people come to expect an authentic Nita. So I feel really comfortable about that in almost everything that I do. Mm-hmm. And I also recognize that that is risky if you're in scenarios where you're surrounded by people that are not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it puts you in a position to be the teacher of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
But I get to sleep at night very well because I know that I'm authentically Nita.
Mm-hmm.
And one more thing I'll add to that. It's interesting. I was talking to a young emerging leader last night, and he said, Nita, I don't understand how you actually do that. How do you do that at work and you're not afraid? And I said, what you have to be sure to do is to always be anchored in something outside of your work. If you're always defined by the employer, then you'll always walk in fear to some degree. You have to have an anchor place. And whether that's your community work or your church or your family or whatever that is, you have to have an anchor place. And when you have an anchor place, it allows you to not walk in fear in the place that gives you the paycheck. Mm-hmm. And that has made life a lot easier for me, too, because my anchor place is in community work around social and economic justice issues. Mm-hmm. And I feel very anchored mm-hmm. that that is the ultimate support system for me. And it makes me almost fearless when I get to work.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting because I hear many people, as they're moving up, it's an interesting phenomenon of feeling more and less fear, both, but more fear. It's like, I call it the heroine of capitalism, in the sense of the more stuff you get, the more you see you want more stuff.
That's right.
And so you get afraid of losing something you might have if you really are yourself or step forward when others are stepping back.
That's right. That's right. That's a true statement. True statement. My philosophy is you can never lose with community. I don't know a soul in history or presently that has lost with community mm-hmm. if you're authentic mm-hmm. in it.
And do you feel that you've ever paid the price for being out as a lesbian in your community or at work?
You know, I think it's a complicated matter for me. There's a very progressive part of me and a very traditional part of me. I grew up in the South. I have very Southern traditional values. I grew up in the church. I still am very much immersed in the traditional Black church. And we know some of the history of the traditional Black church, not necessarily that fond of people like me, and I really don't care about that because that's not why I'm there. And so, you know, sometimes that's hard. Sometimes I become the symbol of maybe it's okay if it's okay for her. And in some cases, I've been the martyr where I've had to step forward because other people were afraid to step forward. I'm also a mother. I'm a mother of a 25-year-old daughter. And you have to imagine what it was like raising a child in the LGBT community and how confusing that was for others and sometimes for her. Mm-hmm. And so there have been lots of cases where I have felt like the outcast or the anomaly in whatever I was doing. And again, that sort of pain I just used to fuel other things. And I think it's worked out beautifully in my life. Not easily, mm-hmm. but beautifully.
Right. Again, the way through pain is through the pain.
That's right.
Well, I know that we are out of time. Talked about some issues, and there's a lot more to explore. And I thank you so much for your helping us think through some of these issues together on the show tonight.
Well, thank you. I would love to come back and really appreciate you giving voice to things that I think will be on the forefront of what we'll have to look at as a community.
You've been listening to Dr. Nita Mosby, Henry Now Tyler, and we are on part one from 2015 and are going to part two during August at my next show. We'll be going deeper into these topics and more. I invite you to join us at that time. You can always catch Outsources at 6:30 every Monday night. Or you can always get it on the news blog, news.kgnu.org, or you can go to kgnu.org and look up Outsources for the archives. In the meantime, my Zell Museum will be presenting Kendi talking about his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. One Book, One Boulder is going to be So You Want to Talk About Race by Oluo, and there'll be lots of events all fall around that book. Lafayette Reads is choosing White Fragility to start their quarterly book discussions by D'Angelo. Stay safe. We care about you. Good evening. This is Karen Rayforth, and this is Outsources.